This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on October 18th, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
October 18th, 2012 will come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for October 4th. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the minutes for the meeting, the open meeting of October 4th, 2012, as set forth in agenda document number 12-73.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Is there a late submitted document? Is there a motion?
I believe there are two, actually. Two documents, not two motions. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 12-72A and 12-74.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, A09-08. We have a presentation this morning from Mr. Hache and Mr. Faven. Did I say your last name properly?
Hache.
Oh, I was way off. Way off. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Commissioners? The Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum for the Minnesota DFL was held over from the last meeting for further discussion. At this point, I'll just go over what our recommendations were for that, for the memorandum, and we'd be available to answer any questions. Basically, there were two findings in the audit, a misstatement of financial activity. A recommendation for the misstatement was that we recommend that the commission find that the Minnesota DFL misstated their 2007-2008 activity failed to report non-federal salaries and taxes paid from their payroll account. And our second recommendation on the misstatement is that we recommend that the commission find that the Minnesota DFL misstated activity in 2008 and failed to report an in-kind contribution in the amount of $10,000. Since the source and permissibility of the contribution remains in question, the audit staff further recommends that the commission request the Minnesota DFL to disgorge $10,000 to the U.S. Treasury. The second finding in the audit was an overfunding of federal accounts by the non-federal accounts, and our recommendation is that the commission find that the Minnesota DFL has demonstrated that its non-federal accounts did not overfund its federal accounts. We're available for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Commissioner Walther?
No, I just move we approve the recommendations.
That was quick. Is there any discussion on the motion? Commissioner McGann?
I won't be able to support the motion.
Okay.
That was great.
Okay.
Do you want me to stay why? Or what? If we want to vote on the report as recommended, we can do that. That's
okay.
Right, if that's what they want to do, that's fine.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Steve, that... the motion's properly before us. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails 3-3. Any other questions or comments about this audit?
Let me just ask for some clarification. Is there any, since there were two recommendations, would that be the vote on the other, for both of you, on both of those?
I'm sorry?
There's two recommendations. Would a segregated vote make a difference? If there is, I'd be glad to, you know, piecemeal the motion, the second motion.
Sure, I think we agree with the recommendations of finding two, which is the overall funding, which turned out to be okay. So we want to move part of the audit. We can support part of the audit.
Well, maybe for clarification, I'd move that we approve of finding one. and then I'll make a motion on finding two. Is that not? Does that not work? Am I missing something?
All right, so your motion is to approve finding one?
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Then I move we approve finding two.
Okay. Motion is to approve finding two. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion passed, 6-0. Any other questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair?
So I assume the end result is that we will issue an, well, I guess this we're just at the drafting stage. We're not at the, we still have another document to approve, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Never mind.
And that will be circulated?
And I assume what happens as a result of these votes is that, you know, we'll have an, at the end of the day, we'll have an audit report that approves finding two, and then the discussion from finding one moves into additional issues. Yes?
That's correct.
Okay.
There you go. All righty. Thank you very much. The next matter on the agenda is Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on RightMarch.com PAC A09-23.
Madam Chair, I think this is held over at my request.
Yes.
I was trying to consider in my own mind whether or not a contingency agreement should be disclosed or not, if it were and in what circumstances. But as I look at the agreement and go through it, I view that my view is that whatever methodology is the appropriate way to do it, there should be some type of disclosure as we go forward. And I'm told that there's a way that you could report it either as debt with a notation that it's a contingent debt, or maybe under Form 99, you can talk about the fact that this is something else that's going on and explain what it is. But in some type of disclosure, whatever methodology would be appropriate, that would be my recommendation. So I would vote for that finding. Whereas before, I wasn't so sure.
Commissioner McGann.
Could I ask, do we think it's contingent debt or we think it's debt? Because I think those who have to do these contracts in the future will want to know whether or not there's a reporting issue, I think, is a separate issue. But when people review these contracts and advise clients, they probably want to know, are we saying that it's contingent debt or are we saying it's actually debt? Or do you think it just doesn't matter because it needs to be reported either way?
Asking me to give an answer for the commission?
No, you.
Well, I think there's a potential that, first of all, I think the contract is not clear to me exactly how it would be implemented. And as I get down into it, it says, for example, the client may elect. Well, if they don't elect, it's not exactly sure what exactly would happen. And I'm as I read through it, I mean, before I'd be willing to sign it, there'd be a lot of questions I'd want to have answered. So if you want to refer to this, I'd say it's too vague to say one way or the other, except I wouldn't sign this thing. But
unfortunately, we're sitting in judgment of those who have.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but there's enough of a potential for a debt to be incurred that I think, regardless of how you look at it, that I think it needs to be disclosed. For example, here it's... the campaign may decide, wait a minute, our clients are only going to get, my clients are going to give $100 and I'm only getting potentially five, maybe less. And that may come to pass fairly quickly that that's not a good public relations contract to enter into, and they may want to get out and they can't, and they find out there's a lot of money being owed. And, you know, to me, I think in the interest of disclosure of the potential liability and the fact that money is being made and generated by it, it's not just the potential liability on something other than money, then I think we should have a disclosure with the opportunity to be able to dig further on it if the public felt they wanted to, rather than get to the very end of it and say 0000 and say, $500,000 is owed. And that, I think, is much more risky in terms of disclosure than to provide disclosure as a, you know, on a monthly basis of how it's being accrued, or and then point out that it's contingent or there's some contingency involved. But, you know, we're kind of confining ourselves to this document, and I don't think we should live and die by what the terms of this say in terms of giving clients advice in the future, because I don't know how prevalent a document like this is, but pretty risky.
Well, that's the problem. People are, whether we think they should or not, people are going to look to this and this contract to see what works and what doesn't work, because these kind of deals are somewhat prevalent. And if the view is that the contract is too vague to even say when the debt occurs, but we know there's some debt in there somewhere, at least that's debt. But if it's a contingent debt, the rule doesn't require reporting of contingent debt. And I guess maybe we do agree, I think, that at least it is the terms of the contract that govern the relationship between the parties and whether or not there's debt. Right. At least people should be able to, if they write a clear enough contract, at least they know they're in charge of their own destiny because they're in charge of their own contract. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think that certainly the contents of the contract are going to govern that, and I'm not comfortable using this as a basis for, you know, giving anybody in the public advice on which direction to go.
Okay.
But you know. There are significant potential liabilities in being incurred along the line, and I think in this particular case, I wouldn't call it a pure contingency contract. Pure. Madam Chair, I'd move to approve all three findings.
Okay. Give us 1 second. The motion is to approve the audit division recommendation memorandum. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion fails 3-3. Are there any other motions?
Well, I move to approve findings 1 and 3.
Would you might maybe consider just moving finding 1 for now?
Sure.
Thank you. All those in favor of finding 1?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Finding 1 passes 6-0. Any other motions?
Well, I'll move Seriatim if you want to get the record.
Easier.
Okay. Commissioner Walther?
I proceed that way. I move that we approve finding number 2.
Okay. All those in favor? Or there's a
discuss the motion from
yes,
Madam
yes,
Chair.
Absolutely.
I agree with parts of finding 2. The part that the respondent demonstrated that the terms of the contract are in the normal course of the vendor's business. I think there's agreement with that part. The part that we that I disagree with is the whether it's debt, and I think that's part of finding two. Is that part of finding two? Yes,
that's correct. Yeah,
okay, good. I'm reading the report correctly. So I just want to state that because when this goes, when it has to be rewritten, I think it would probably help the auditors to know that there is agreement on part of finding two. It's just a portion that there's disagreement.
Madam Vice Chair.
I'm sure it's helpful for the auditors to know that, but if there's a vote and it splits 3-3 on the entire finding, then the whole thing is going to move to additional issues. So if there's some part of this that you're willing to approve, then I think you need to you don't need to do anything, but it would be preferable, I think, to move to approve that part of it so that part of it could be in the main body of the report, and then the actual issue of contention would be isolated in the additional issues. Am I getting that right?
That would be preferable, yes, ma'am.
But I can't do that for you because I don't know. You know, it's up to you which part you're willing to agree with or not.
Well, it's not a friendly amendment, right? He's moved finding two. Mm-hmm. Right, so we should vote that down, and then I can make a motion on the part of finding two.
That's
how I would suggest we do it procedurally. And although, you know, I appreciate the vice chair saying it, but that's the next step after we vote on the pending motion.
Yes, I didn't realize you were going to make a subsequent motion. That's all.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion fails 3-3. Is there another motion? Commissioner McGann.
I'd like to move the part of finding two that concludes that RMC demonstrated that the terms of the contract are in the normal course of the vendor's business, and the appropriate supporting language in the report that supports that conclusion and the conclusion in finding two.
Thank you. All those in favor? Oh, yes, sure. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. I'm looking at the memo, and I just want to check in with the auditors. I hadn't realized that was part of the finding. That was a finding itself. Is that if you can help me? I understand it's part of the underlying. You know, there's a lot of stuff that usually happens in the lead up to a finding, and a lot of legal issues and factual issues get resolved. But was that a finding that you made?
Yes, part of the finding, there were two parts to it, the extension of credit, whether that was permissible, and then the reporting of the debt.
Okay, so you view those as separate findings?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Separate issues within the finding. But.
Okay.
Wait.
So is that what the first sentence means, that audit staff determined that the – is that what you're saying is the first piece of the finding? I'm just trying to understand in the memo where this splits out. Because the recommendation is to find that they failed to disclose the debt, so that's why I was confused.
Commissioner McGann?
Yeah, the first sentence, we determined that that there was no impermissible extension of credit. And then what remained was that they failed to disclose the debt. So that's the only remaining issue, is the disclosure of the debt. We don't find the first part to be a matter that needs to be pursued.
Commissioner McGann?
Let me ask you, if the first part, meaning whether the contract was in the normal course of the vendor's business, right? If it wasn't a normal course, that would result in an in-kind contribution. So it wouldn't be a debt reporting issue. It would have been a more serious problem.
Correct.
It would have been an in-kind. And they spent... We have the submission by the Political Call Center, LLC, in response to prepared by counsel for them, explaining why this contract was not out of the norm. So once that issue went away, it became a debt reporting issue. So you don't get to support the debt reporting issue without buying into the predicate decision that this is not an in-kind. Right? I mean, the debt issue is contingent on the first issue. It depends how you, right? If it's a corporate in-kind, it's not, you don't really, the debt, I guess you could still report it as debt, but,
yeah,
but that's reporting illegal conduct. So.
Yeah, there were two issues addressed here. One, whether it was a permissible extension of credit, and they resolved that. The second part was the requiring of disclosure of what we thought was a debt.
Okay.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, at the risk of being inconsistent, now that I've heard it all laid out, I'm not actually convinced that it's possible to parse it out that way. Or it may be possible to parse it out that way, but I'm not sure I'm comfortable voting for the motion the way it's been expressed, because what we do here is we approve findings, particular findings, and there's a finding on extension of credit. There aren't two findings in there. There's one finding. Now, maybe we're back to where Commissioner McCann started, that it may well be informative to the auditors to know that commissioners thought that part of the analysis was correct. But in terms of approving the finding, there isn't a finding on that to approve.
There isn't at this stage. The reason I thought that was a better course was, and I believe it was in a prior audit, and I think it was Friends of Wiener, where there was a misstatement issue, and we took part of the issue out and moved it to other issues, and part of the finding remained. So that's why I thought in this case they've addressed the first part of the finding, and nothing else needs to be done, but the second part remains an issue because they didn't disclose the debt. So that's why I thought it would be better, as suggested, to be done in two parts, that there be a finding on, that we addressed a finding with respect to the permissibility of the contribution, and that turned out okay. And what would go to other issues is the fact that had to be reported as a debt, and there may not be agreement on that.
But that's not, I hear you, but that's not what you did. That's not the way this is laid out.
Not the way it's recommended in the ADRM.
Right. There could potentially have been a different recommendation
Correct,
that split those issues out, but that's not what we have in front of us.
Wait a second. Hold on. Yes, it is. Do I have the right document? Because I have finding two, it's page 6. It says finding two, extension of credit by a commercial vendor. Mm-hmm. Right?
Correct.
And what are we? We are finding that there was not an extension of credit by a commercial vendor.
Correct.
Correct. Right? So the way it's captioned in the audit report is extension of credit by a commercial vendor. And my motion read verbatim from the summary sheet, which is copied again in the actual analysis, page 12, says, based on the additional information provided in response to the interim audit report, right? Because the interim report actually said it was an in-kind.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And the commission saw that document, and that went through the commission.
Correct.
So we agree with the auditors up until that point. The respondents in this matter beat that back, so to speak. They demonstrated to the auditors that any extension of credit was in the ordinary course of business and thus did not contribute to an excessive in-kind contribution. That reading is right from the report.
Correct.
This is what we're voting on, and we've already had a vote that's gone 3-3 where half the commission has already supported that. At this stage, not only this stage, but in the interim stage. I mean, the converse was true at the interim stage
that it was a
potential problem, and now they've demonstrated that it's not a problem. And what's
correct.
Left is whether they should have reported it as debt. But the finding is, it's extension of credits, the finding.
Madam Vice Chair.
Well, I think part of the problem is that we're not actually voting on the draft final audit report. We're voting on the audit division recommendation memorandum on rightmarch.com PAC. And this is the sort of Byzantine process that we've come up with, and that has a finding. Finding 2 on page 1 of agenda document 12-65. And I think what we have in front of us is, you know, the procedurally what we need to do is adopt or not finding 2 in the recommendation memorandum. That's my point. It could have been done differently, I suppose, but that's the way it's in front of us.
Mr. McGinn.
That's why I thought we just vote on finding 2, and then if we wanted to show agreement, that's why I just said what I said, because they're going to have to rewrite this, and I think there is agreement on the issue that has been resolved to the auditor's satisfaction. Now, if for some reason, is there disagreement on the predicate issue here? I mean, is there an extension of credit that results in an in-kind contribution? The auditors don't think so. We don't think so, we being half of the commission. Does the other half disagree with the auditors on this point?
Commissioner Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I read this correctly, though, there's a lot of ifs left in this draft, and I'm a little reluctant to say in the interim stage, okay, fine, we'll move ahead with you on this, but you point out two things that late last night I was concerned about, and that was, although contracts from similar vendors were provided, PA did not provide for this review any additional contracts it had with other clientele.
That's correct.
It also said, because of this, it does appear these types of contracts may be fairly standard in the industry.
That's correct.
And based upon those two facts, I'm a little reluctant to say today that I'm going to buy off on that point 100%.
We felt that was enough to determine it was a normal course of business based on all the other contracts we have, even though we didn't have one. I believe... And Rhonda can correct me if I'm wrong. I believe we had an affidavit
from
the treasurer.
Affidavit's nice, but it's not the best evidence. If you're looking at evidence, we're talking documents.
Yeah. No, I understand. But based on the affidavit and all the other contracts, we felt that was enough to determine that there wasn't an extension of credit. It was in the normal course of business.
Why wouldn't they hand the contracts over to you? I mean, was there any discussion about that? Because you were looking at other contracts from other vendors, apparently, that were similar. But
I can only assume that they were requested from council, but the council are the ones that actually went out and got contracts. Political advertising never gave any contracts to the council.
So my vote was really to support, okay, at this stage we'll buy off on your theory, but I would like to be able to say at some point, let's see what the evidence shows. I mean, maybe it's a contribution, maybe it's a debt. I don't. Right now, you're buying off on the idea that it's a debt. I think that's reasonable. I mean, I there certainly is a potential for a huge debt, so that's an easy one. But I think it might be premature to try and parse it out. I'm not sure where that gets us.
Commissioner McGinn.
Just so the record's clear, the auditors originally suspected that this was an impermissible extension of credit. When I say impermissible, meaning for purposes of FICA, an impermissible in-kind contribution.
That's correct.
It wasn't Rightmarch, it was the folks providing the fundraising service that spent all sorts of money proving this up. There's a 20-page legal brief in the file that does attach contracts that are similar to this contract. So to say that, well, what, you know, that this commercial for-profit business didn't produce actual contracts by all its other clients, to me is a red herring, because it doesn't have to. There's confidentiality issues. They don't have to give us their client list, but they have given us quite a bit of information that demonstrates that this contract is well within the norm of what they do in their ordinary course of business. Now, let me ask the auditors, first, that, to make sure that I'm not overstating or understating the record, but two, they have given examples of other contracts or language or something, right? This is not just a situation where they did a one-page affidavit and you said, oh, that's fine. We have a 20-page legal brief here. There was a lot of discussion on this issue. These folks spent a lot of money on a fancy lawyer at Wiley Ryan who used to chair this agency to explain that this was okay. This isn't cheap. So could you elaborate a little bit on this issue about how much went into your recommendation? Because this does, I don't want this to be portrayed as you guys just said, oh, close enough, and moved on. This seems like a very – and I would actually – if we're going to criticize, I would say you guys dug too deep on this because that's just more my thing. But, you know, you have to do what you need to do and be satisfied as an auditor. But to me, it's overkill what they went through.
They did supply the affidavit from the head of political advertising who said it was standard industry, what she did give to other their clients. And the attorney did provide 32 contracts from various all different types of committees and organizations, of which I went through every single one of those painstakingly. And it does seem to be, based on those contracts, an industry standard. In fact, maybe they even got a little bit more than a lot of those contracts allowed. They were given 5%. So based on what we had, that's how we made our decision.
What do they do at the end of the contract? Do they have that monthly invoice that keeps creeping up to the point where you go broke if you decide you want out of it?
At the end of the contract, at the end of that contract, which was August 15, 2012, that phase would be over, and anything that was left from the invoicing would just simply be gone, as long as they didn't terminate the contract.
In the other contracts?
Yes.
Mr. Calvert, did you have a comment or someone?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson? Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that I understand where we are right now. We just had a motion on finding all of finding two, to approve all of finding two, and obviously part, the first issue that was resolved in that finding is that that the auditors concluded that there wasn't an impermissible extension of credit. But now, just hearing the subsequent discussion, it sounds like Commissioner Walter, do you actually not approve of that first? Because it sounded like you have some questions about whether or not even that portion is correct. So I just want to know where we have agreement and where we don't.
No, I'm buying off on it for today. But I think when it comes to the point where people say, "Hey, whoa, wait a minute, you." You know, we can't discuss this further as we go forward, as facts might come up. I want to be able to say, you know, we went that far, but there may be some issues there that are still outstanding. I was aware that other contracts were provided, but that always makes me concerned when they provide somebody else's contracts and not their own, and I just didn't know what to make of that. And then it sounded like there's kind of a tepid language on the part of the audit staff on it, so I thought it's still an open question, but I'm willing to, you know, I will support going for finding two to get us down the road.
Mr. Calvert?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to clarify, Commissioner Walter, that we were trying to follow one of the pieces of precedent on this, an advisory opinion from way back in 1991 involving the New York State Democratic Party. Which considered an arrangement very much like this, concluded that it was an in-kind contribution, but it concluded that it was an in-kind contribution in the absence of a record presented by the requester of a similar type of program by the vendor or by other vendors in the industry. In the opinion, either one would do. And it was our conclusion, and I'd refer you to our comments on the draft report at page 7 of our comments, that a significant difference in this matter and the 1991 advisory opinion was that the committee and the vendor here had provided a record of the sort that had not been provided in AO 1991-18. It is correct that what we got from the vendor about its own practices was an affidavit from the president, but we did get 32 contracts that they had obtained from other vendors somehow, both on fundraising projects done for other political committees and fundraising projects done for non-political committee nonprofits. And we went, in our comments, we go through where the parts of this contract that gave us the most pause, and compared those to what was in the contracts of the other vendors to determine whether or not there was there seemed to be an adherence to industry practice. And at the end of the day, we recommended to the audit division there was no income contribution here.
Well, I mean, that's a really good input, and I appreciate it. And I'm softening up a little bit on that. But as Brad will, my EA will tell you that we discussed this, and my original gut was there was a contribution, and we were going on and on about that, and I wasn't ready to completely buy off on that today. But on the other hand, it sounds like you really did cover that point well.
Mr. McGann?
Can I ask try to clarify so that folks who listen in here and are subject to this audit know what we may or may not be doing? Political Call Center LLC is the company that provided the service to Right March. Right March is, of course, the group that's been audited. Political Call Center has this contract. They've signed it with Right March. If Political Call Center were to use the same exact contract with its next customer, is it the position of the commission, some subset of the commission, that would result in an in-kind? It would seem to me, after supporting finding two in total, Political Call Center now can use this contract again and again and again, and it will not result in an in-kind. This customer will have to report debt, perhaps, depending on how one wants to read the votes at the commission. But it seems to me Political Call Center can use this contract. I'm not talking about other people or or expansive version of the contract. Same exact language. It's the same exact contract with their next customer. Are we going to have this same discussion if that customer gets audited? Or is this actually deciding this contract is okay, which I think that's already been decided in part by supporting finding two?
Commissioner Bowerly? From my perspective, I think the question here is there's always parts of findings that we probably could find some small agreement on. And I think the only question is, at what point is it a separate finding, or is it some predicate course to a finding that we're getting to? For example, in the audit we just voted on, there was a recommendation to find that audit staff recommends the commission find that Minnesota DFL has demonstrated its non-federal accounts did not overfund its federal accounts. That obviously was the result of part of the process. I'm sure there were, we could split lots of things out. I think my original question to the auditors was, is this a separate finding? We sometimes make, I guess I call them positive findings, affirmative conclusions. That wasn't the recommendation here. That's why I asked the original question. It's not clear to me that this is one of those findings that easily splits out. We don't often make findings that are issues that were resolved along the way when we're getting to other findings. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. This one wasn't presented to us. And we have this, I have lots of issues with Directive 70, but this is what we're voting on, is this recommendation. So that's kind of where I'm stuck. But
Commissioner McGann.
So can they use the contract or can't they? The finding is extension of credit by a commercial vendor. Did they extend credit by a commercial vendor that's an in-kind, or didn't they? That's what the finding asks. The debt issue is something that only arose after the main meat of the finding came and went. So can they use the contract or can't they use the contract? We have to decide that today. We can't pretend like that's not before us. It is. It's squarely before us. We owe it to the public to make decisions on things so that people know what they can do in the future. Can this company use this contract or can't they?
Madam Vice Chair?
Well, the part that I disagree with is whether it's squarely before us. I mean, I think part of the problem is that the finding is actually mislabeled because it started out at the interim stage in a different direction. It's labeled, you know, we all know headings aren't dispositive. The heading on finding two is extension of credit by a commercial vendor, but the recommendation, the thing that we are supposed to vote on under Directive 70 says the audit staff recommends that the commission find that RMC failed to disclose debts totaling a little over $1.5 million. So that's actually the finding.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me ask first the auditors and then perhaps Mr. Calvert can help me out. What this may be would be a bit unusual since the finding is based on the same underlying nucleus of facts, but what if we were to split the finding so that we had one finding that was about the extension of credit, and the other and a new finding, it could be finding three, and we push three to four, that would be on the disclosure of debt. Would that present any logistical problems or any other problems for the auditors?
None that I can think of.
Okay. And Mr. Calvert, is there anything under our own procedures that would create any roadblocks for us to move to split the finding two and make that two separate findings?
There is not, Commissioner. As a matter of fact, Directive 70 does contain some provisions that that perhaps would have been helpful here, in that it says that the draft final audit report, to the extent possible, should break separate components of a finding into separate sub-findings to facilitate ease of consideration and voting by the commission. And if commissioners here wished to, given the theory behind Directive 70, the final report is the commission's document, the commission wished to take votes on the sub-findings and direct that the PFAR come back with separate, breaking those into separate findings or into sub-findings within a finding, or however you all would want to have it divided, that can be done.
Okay. Madam Chair, can we all take a minute?
You can take a minute, sure.
5 minutes, 3 minutes?
Sure.
All right.
Consideration of the audit. There is a motion on the table made by Commissioner McGann. Any further comments on the motion? Commissioner Walther?
Yeah, previously I mentioned that I'd like to hold it over so that we can consider maybe the impact of how to divide that into pieces, and so that we can vote on all of the potential pieces at the same time. In other words, I have no objection to breaking down the elements of the finding if that's the will of these three of you. No problem there. But I think we ought to take a look at each of the elements and get them phrased so that we can all vote on at the same time.
Okay. So if we carry this over to the next meeting, the motion, Commissioner McGann, I believe, doesn't wish to withdraw his motion. So if we table it, my understanding is that that would revive itself at the next open meeting.
Yes.
Is that correct, Mr. Calvert?
I believe that's correct, Madam Chair. Under Directive 10, it is proper for the commission, either by motion or unanimous consent, to postpone consideration of a matter to a date certain. If by motion, obviously, that would have to be done by majority vote. If by unanimous consent, as is customary, the matter is held over, I see in Directive 10 nor Roberts any particular impediment to resuming at this point when the overall main matter comes back before the commission the next time.
To resuming the discussion of the motion that's on the table?
Yes.
Okay. Any additional comments? If not, we will reconsider. We will continue considering the motion that's on the table at the next open meeting. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda was Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Friends of Sharon Engel. That matter was approved prior to the open meeting today. Therefore, the next matter on the agenda is the proposed final audit report on the Los Angeles County Democratic Central Committee, A09-07. Whenever you're ready.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you is the proposed final audit report on the Los Angeles County Democratic Central Committee. The report was originally circulated on September 24th, 2012. The report has been revised, and it contains edits in response to the commissioner's concerns. We're prepared at this point to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've discussed this one before and for a while, and we had an audit hearing, and I think the issue that has that the commission's been trying to address is how to accurately describe what happened here, given the interesting legal developments with respect to the committee's treasurer, and the commission made some changes to the. To the report to explain the Kindy Durkee situation. There's now a paragraph that says Ms. Durkee was has pleaded guilty to 5 counts of mail fraud and admitted to defrauding more than 10 and maybe 50 or more of her clients of at least $7 million. And that has complicated the fact that she was the treasurer. Has complicated how to fully and accurately explain what happened here. The committee is ultimately responsible, even if they have a treasurer who turns out to be not entirely trustworthy. The committee is still responsible for making sure that its reports are accurate, and there are still two misstatement findings, which I think is appropriate. And we've had some back and forth with counsel, current counsel for the committee. And they have, in an email that, I don't know whether this email is part of the public record, will become part of the public record, but I think it probably should be part of the public record. We've had an email from counsel where they asked us if we would consider making a couple of more changes. One, and I'll say that initially I was not inclined to do that. I think there's a little bit of a problem with our making a lot of accommodations to counsel after our auditors have presented us with a report, and it fairly and accurately sets forth their findings, which the commission has or will adopt. I don't think we can allow the committees to write their own audit report. But I do think that there was one point that was fairly made by counsel, and that was that there are several references in the proposed final audit report to counsel, and what it really means is the former counsel. And the reason why that's significant is that all of the, as I understand it, all the statements that are attributed to counsel in this report actually refer to the former counsel that the committee had hired before they discovered the misconduct of the treasurer. And after they discovered that, they fired the treasurer, they fired the lawyers, they started all over again. And I think that it's not just a question of professional pride on the part of the current counsel that they don't want to be tagged with the advice that the former counsel gave, but rather that it could be confusing to people who are reading the report because it looks like the committee is shifting its positions, which indeed it did once it discovered what had happened. So I think in this case to insert the word former before the word counsel throughout the report, because I don't think there's any place in the report that the I think it comes up about eight times, and I don't think it's on page 8, 9, and 12, and 13, and I don't think that any of them refer to the current counsel, and it might actually add clarity to the report and make it less confusing for people to read. And for that reason, I have a slight preference for making the change. People don't want to make the change. I'm not terribly hung up on it. But I think it might actually clarify things a little bit.
Commissioner McGann?
I can support that. That makes sense. This is a difficult situation for the committee, and this is certainly not them writing their own audit report. I think it was up to them. There wouldn't be any findings at all, and it would be a much cleaner bill of health. And yes, we did have a hearing on this, and the chair flew out himself and spoke to the commission. So that's another expense the committee's had to endure because of the wrongdoings of someone they trusted. The committee raises a couple other issues on edits, which I found to be persuasive. Page 2 in the background section, the proposed report does include a description of what's captioned unauthorized activity of former treasurer. That begins actually page 1, then it goes to page 2. Then it concludes by saying the LACDCC was unable to provide documentation to support its belief that all the transactions addressed in the findings in this report resulted from Ms. Durkee's unauthorized activity. The kind of activities described in her plea agreement as outlined above, however, could account for many of the problems identified during the audit and cited in this report. I think that's okay as far as it goes, but as I think as the committee correctly, in my view, points out, what's not made clear there is that it wasn't that they're uncooperative, and the fear is that someone reads this and says it looks like they just didn't provide documents and somehow that's a problem. I mean, ordinarily in other audits, when there's a language that says you didn't provide documents, that's usually a bad thing. It's still a bad thing, but there's a reason why. So I would suggest that we edit the paragraph and include at the beginning of that paragraph, because LACDCC's documents were maintained by Ms. Durkee, comma, the committee, and strike LACDCC in the original. So it would be the committee was unable to provide documentation to support its belief that all the transactions addressed in the findings in this report resulted from Ms. Durkee's unauthorized activity. The next sentence in the paragraph raises an issue for me, because it says the activity, the gist of the sentence I wholeheartedly agree with. And the gist is that the activities described could be the reason why the audit findings are the way they are. I mean, essentially, what was reported and what was in the bank don't match. You know, stripped to its essence, that's the problem here. And I don't want anyone to read this to say that the commission is deciding that there are some problems that aren't due to the actions of Durkee. We can't say all the problems are due to Durkee at this stage, because we don't know, and that's the point. And if there's a way to edit the sentence to make that clearer, I can support that. My suggestion is strike many of, so it just will be that could account for the problems identified during the audit and cited in this report. Still has the word could, so it still leaves it in the air. But by striking for many, it eliminates the distinction that I think some might draw unintentionally down the road. And I think that addresses the third point that the committee raises, and I'm not sure we can fix this, because we do have this section at the beginning describing what happened, is that it's not clearly spelled out in each finding. I think it would unnecessarily bog down the findings. Maybe one way to do it is either footnote or first sentence, you know, somehow incorporating by reference, or, you know, in light of the background set out in the introduction, comma, and then law. So at least it's incorporated, acknowledges Durkee in the actual finding. My guess is the committee, and this is just a guess, that the committee is worried that someone takes part of this out of context and just copies the finding, and there's no reference to Durkee in the actual finding. So they're afraid that that'll cause them to have to explain down the road something that was explained at the beginning of the document. It seems to be a fair point to me, if it's done in a way that doesn't bog down the actual substance of the finding. I'm not sure there's a way to not make a finding. The reality is it the books and it versus what was in the bank versus what was reported just doesn't match, and it's a very sad situation for the committee. But from the auditor's point of view, it is what the numbers are the numbers, and I certainly understand that. And I think this report, though, does go a long way to putting why the numbers don't match in context. And to the extent we could clarify it a little bit more, I think that would be not out of the norm, and I think it would be better off for all involved.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think that we have gone a long way to ensure that people know what really happened here, and I think this whole introductory section about the unauthorized activity is very useful. I wouldn't object to adding the former counsel language in just to clarify that if that's necessary. And I also agree that there's no need to suggest that the committee, once the treasurer left the building, shall we say, was uncooperative. But I think the language that the committee actually suggested, I think, might be more workable, because I'm not sure that all of the documents were maintained by Ms. Durkee. They obviously had some of their own documents. We obviously were able to look at some of the documents, some which were maintained by her, some which were maintained by the committee. So I think I would suggest maybe we go with the language the committee actually suggested for that paragraph that says the committee, LACDCC, provided what documentation and information it could obtain to support its belief. I mean, I think they did, since the revelation of what happened, they have worked pretty hard. The reality is, I think there will be a lot that will never be known about some of the transactions that happened here, and this is where we're left. So the findings are appropriate, but their recommendation for that entire paragraph was to make that change to suggest that they provided what they could, and I think that's a fair point. So unless the auditors would have concerns about that description unless you think that's in an inaccurate description of what actually happened here, I would suggest that activity and that change, and that's the change that they suggested for that paragraph.
Yeah, we believe that would be okay.
Fine by me. I didn't realize they had offered specific language. Now that I see it, they did. I was paraphrasing, so we use their suggested language for the final.
Is there a motion to incorporate everything that's been discussed? Good luck.
I think I can.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
The other point they raise is working into the findings themselves, more of a reference to the potential cause. They don't offer specific language. What they say is, we urge that the conclusion section of finding two relating to the committee's Levin account contain a reference to Ms. Durkee's embezzlement activity as a possible basis for the misstated transactions. Current version does not refer to the embezzlement. I can support putting that in. And I raised that point earlier. I just don't know how to do it. Is it just a simple dependent clause tacked on to the existing sentence? There's different ways to do it.
And Vice Chair?
As I read, we got a letter and we got an email. And as I read the email, I think that the letter was sent before we posted on our website the revised audit report, because we had been making changes internally, but we didn't make them public until yesterday. And I think the letter came in before we did that and was a response to the earlier draft. The email, I think, came in later and says, thank you for forwarding this revised version. We appreciate that some of the changes requested in our letter were already identified by your staff and incorporated into this latest version. And then they specifically asked again about the referring to the council as former council and further refining the paragraph on page 2, the one we were just talking about. And that's all they asked for in the email. So the way I read the email is that after they saw the revisions to the report, those were their only two remaining issues. And I went back and reread the report again, and I think with all the additional language at the front end and at the back end of the report, I think it actually is pretty clear now.
Fine. Fair enough. Thanks for that. Yeah, the chain of the letter and the email, I was confused. That's very helpful.
And both the letter and the email are public at this point. Are they going to be shortly?
The letter is... The email, I think, will be shortly.
Okay. Thank you.
Just to clarify, Madam Chair, in terms of the public record, what's posted at the conclusion of the audit, since Directive 70 doesn't provide for comments of this sort at this point, it's not in the list of what goes public, but if it's the consensus of the commission, then in these circumstances, these documents ought to be added. The commission can instruct us to do that.
I believe that is what we would like. Thank you. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. I agree that would be appropriate, because obviously it has, although we've pretty much discussed the substance of it here at the table, it has influenced the document, and I think it would be inappropriate not to have that on the public record so that everybody can see exactly how these things happen. Okay, I'm going to take a crack at a motion here. I move that we approve agenda document number 12-72A, proposed final audit report on the Los Angeles County Democratic Central Committee A09-07, except that in the eight places where the former council is merely referred to as council, on pages 8, 9, 12, and 13, that we insert the word former so that it's clear that it was the former council who was making those representations, and that the paragraph on page 2 of the proposed final audit report, in the middle of the page, right above the heading audit hearing, that begins, LACDCC was unable to provide documentation, should be replaced with the suggested paragraph in the letter from Mr. Kaufman, the current counsel to the LACDCC, which reads, just to be completely clear, LACDCC provided what documents and information it could obtain to support its belief that all the transactions underlying the findings in the report resulted from Ms. Durkee's unauthorized activity. Moreover, the kind of activities described in her plea agreement as outlined above could account for many of the problems identified during the audit and cited in this report. And that is actually just a few words different from the one that was in the audit report. It's a fairly minor change. And that we also authorize counsel to make public both the letter and the email that we discussed here today.
Thank you very much. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you very much. The next and last matter on the agenda is the notice of availability, the petition for rulemaking on electioneering and communication reporting filed by the Center for Individual Freedom.
Thank you.
Mr. Lutz, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Agenda Document 12-74 is a draft notice of availability for the petition for rulemaking filed by the Center for Individual Freedom. The notice states that the petition is available to the public, that the Commission seeks comments on the petition, and that the comment window will remain open for 60 days. Should the Commission approve the notice, the Office of General Counsel will take the necessary steps to publish the notice in the Federal Register. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions, comments, or motions? Commissioner Welther?
Just for the General Counsel, if once we receive, which we have, your opinion that it meets the requirements of 11 CFR 200B2B, is there any discretion left in the Commission at this point?
Once we have concluded that the procedural requirements under the regulations are met and have so recommended to the Commission, the Commission's regulations require a notice of availability be published in the Federal Register. There is no discretion.
Thank you. In view of that, I mean, I'll support it. I just want, probably as a heads up, I think for us to embark on the slim of rulemaking when we have a huge amount of gaps left in our regulatory process due to some of the cases that have come down since Citizens United, in addition to Citizens United, of course, I think it would be remiss if we didn't have a rulemaking that included or have an advance rulemaking, advance notice of rulemaking, so that we could start hearing from the public on all those issues.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Commissioner Walther. I don't have a problem with our putting out the notice of availability, and indeed, as counsel just advised us, we don't really have a choice. But, you know, it's fine. They've submitted a petition, and we should seek comment on it. But it is, we do find ourselves in sort of an interesting posture, and if somebody wasn't completely in the weeds on this the way we all are, they might find this to be a somewhat confusing turn of events. We're being sued over the validity of this regulation. And the petitioner has intervened in that lawsuit to defend the regulation. We got an opinion from the appellate court that said the regulation was kind of a mess, that it raised more questions than it answered. And we were directed to either to inform the district court whether we were going to commence a rulemaking to address those problems or whether we were going to continue to defend the regulation. So at the last meeting, I made a motion, which sadly failed 3-3, for us to commence that rulemaking. And it's not the first time I've made that motion. So now, surprisingly, the same folks who are defending the regulation in court are coming in and saying, amend the regulation. Now, if you weren't reading really closely, you might think, well, that's an odd turn of events. But in fact, what they're clearly responding to is the Court of Appeals pointing out that the regulation is kind of a mess. And they're asking for a very narrow rulemaking. They're saying just take out a couple of cross-references, and that'll solve the whole problem. I don't think it actually does. So oddly enough, they are both defending the regulation and seeking to amend the regulation. And I think the reason they're seeking to amend the regulation is because they think it'll help them to defend the regulation because it will at least clear up some of the problems. But in my view, and I think probably the view of at least two other commissioners, it's not going to clear up all the problems. Citizens United, what we're talking about is a rulemaking that arose out of the WRTL decision, the Wisconsin Right to Life decision, which was largely superseded by the Citizens United decision. And the Citizens United decision also talked about, in doing so, they talked about disclosure, the importance that the court... Eight justices of the Supreme Court, this part wasn't even 5-4, it was 8-1, they talked about the importance of disclosure and how it helps to create an informed electorate. We've been having this debate for 2 years now, and here we are. You know, the election's 3 weeks away, and millions of dollars are being spent. A lot of money is being spent by outside groups. And it's going to have an impact in this election, perhaps more at the state and in the Senate and the House races, even than at the presidential level, because the presidential candidates, they have raised a lot of money, and they can get into the mix. House and Senate candidates, they've also raised a lot of money, but not quite as much. So $1 million in outside spending that comes in at the last minute in a House or a Senate race could really make a huge difference. And as I said last time, and as the court obviously agrees, it is helpful. It creates a better informed electorate if you actually know who's behind the ads. In Citizens United, the court said there was evidence in the record that, talking about in the McConnell record, that independent groups were running election-related advertisements while hiding behind dubious and misleading names. And this continues to go on, and we continue to not have disclosure of the what was in 2010 tens of millions of dollars of advertisements, and we don't know yet how much the total is going to be in this election, advertisements that are being run without the people receiving them knowing where they're coming from and knowing more than these dubious and misleading names. So I'm happy to, move that we publish this in the Federal Register the way we are bound to do, but I would hope that when people comment on it, they comment on whether it's appropriate for us to engage in such a limited rulemaking when there are much bigger issues that have been already addressed by statute, already addressed by the Supreme Court, that we are would not be addressing in this in any rulemaking that would result from this particular petition. So I'll make a motion whenever you want.
Okay. Any other comments? Commissioner McGann?
Just need to comment on one thing, because I'm hearing it repeated now several times, that the D.C. Circuit has held the rule is a mess and raised more questions than it answers. D.C. Circuit said the questions that remain was because the FEC didn't show up. The FEC didn't appeal. The FEC would have appealed. The FEC would have been part of the argument, and that part of the opinion talks about the FEC not appealing. So to sort of couch that as therefore D.C. Circuit has already pronounced this rule to be a mess or the like, I think is premature, because that's not how I read the opinion. The opinion speaks for itself. It's currently before a federal district judge. She can read case law probably better. Whether it's better or not is irrelevant. She is wearing the black robes and we're not, so the case will speak for itself however she wants to read it. Second, another thing that gets repeated over and over and over and over and over again, which is not true, is that there's no disclosure of all these ads. That's just not true. There's disclosure. There's just not as much as what some people would like. We're not talking about pure anonymous speech here. This is not Ms. McIntyre handing out her flyers without disclaimers. There's disclaimers on these ads. Reports are filed if it comes within the reporting regime. It's just that somewhat more disclosure than what is currently happening. Although the record in McConnell talked about people hiding beyond dubious names and stuff, I think it's really dangerous for a federal agency to announce from the dais that that's happening now, that people who are running ads somehow are hiding behind dubious names and the like. That's really putting the cart before the horse as well, and somewhat inflammatory, because people are speaking, and I don't think they take kindly to being accused of hiding behind shadowy and dubious names without any sort of evidence to back that up. So I just wanted to correct those two points, because I think it, to be kind, overstates what's going on.
Madam Vice Chair.
I was merely quoting the court. If my colleague is concerned about the label dubious and misleading, I think that it is undisputable that there are groups out there that have sort of generic names that are running ads, and people don't know who is behind all of those ads. That's just true. We get electioneering communication reports. They're filed by organizations, and they don't tell us who else is supporting them. That's true.
Why does that make the name misleading?
Well, it's not very informative. As I said, I was quoting the court. I mean, you can take issue with how the Supreme Court characterized it, but...
But the Supreme Court wasn't talking about people running ads today in the 2012 election cycle. There was record evidence in McConnell that backed up the statement the court made. And the point I'm saying is you can't now say, therefore, the Supreme Court has declared someone running an ad today is somehow hiding behind a misleading name. You're accusing people of misleading. And I'd like to know how you can say that when that's... It's just not misleading. It may not be as complete as you would like. You may want to know more information about the groups, but that's not the same as accusing them of being misleading. That's a very serious charge.
Madam Vice Chair?
I think we're arguing on a very fine point of semantics. I would have to, I haven't gone back and searched through the McConnell record to see whether every single group that was in that record is now out of business and no longer running ads. I suspect some of them probably are still in business. But I think, you may disagree with the court's description of dubious and misleading, but it is certainly true that people have very, there are many organizations out there that have very vague names. I don't want to, I'm purposely avoiding naming any of them. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on any particular group out there. But I don't think it would be hard to find a list of names of folks, of organizations that are running ads today that their names are not informative about who they are or what they're trying to accomplish, or what their motives might be. And the court has been very clear that that sort of information is actually useful to the electorate. And I gave one example last time of a group that's running ads, and whether you think yes on question this or no on question this is dubious and misleading, it is not informative about who is behind those advertisements, and it is it is helpful to me as a voter to know who's actually supporting these ads and what their motivations might be. I don't know if we want to keep going back and forth on this or if I should just make the motion.
Any other comments?
Well, then, I move approval of agenda document number 12-74 and direct that the notice be published in the Federal Register and technical and conforming amendments be made and that we authorize counsel to do whatever they need to do in order to effectuate our regulation and perform our responsibilities with respect to this petition.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Mr. Palmer, are there any management or administrative matters?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.